I'm sure there will be some more people drifting in. David Kiesberg, that name sort of rolls off my tongue. I was married on a week ago Sunday, and I used to be David Berg, which is a very kind of ordinary sort of sounding name. And as of last Sunday, I'm now David Kiesberg. And in one of the brighter moves that I've made in my life, among other things, in addition to being a wonderful person and an exciting and fun person to be with, I married a body worker, a person who, as a kind of avocation, does massage work. And so I inherited a lot of comfort of that kind, too. I got married. So we're now beginning our session entitled Stauruk, We Beseech Thee, a lesson in personal stories and the role they play in our life. I'd like to begin by recounting an incident that occurred to me when I was a young boy, and I'm not quite sure exactly what the age was, but I have the feeling that I was probably about in the fourth grade, which would make me 10 years old enough to know better. And a man had come to the parsonage to see my father. I think maybe he was a deacon or someone like that. And he was obviously not happy about something. And my father was shaving, and we were waiting for my father to finish shaving. And so it was my job to entertain this man until my father could get there. And we sat there in a kind of awkward, uneasy silence for a few minutes. And then this man looked over at me and he said, "And young man, when you grow up, what are you going to be?" I kind of straightened myself up and I said, "I think I'm going to be a bartender." And just as I said that, my father walked in the door. And the way I remember the incident, it took him about 60 seconds, more or less, to convince me that bartending is a badly overcrowded profession. And his advice must have taken root because a few days later, and my father served a parish where he preached, but on a rather meager salary, which the congregation tried to make up by providing some acreage. So we had 5 or 6 Guernsey cows and about 100 chickens, and a little land that the men in the parish helped to work. And it must have been 4 or 5 days later, he came out into the barn and he heard a voice speaking. And he came in there and he found me standing on a silage box preaching to the cows. And they were a wonderful audience. I can still remember that. I've never had a congregation since that gave quite that undivided attention. I can still see those beautiful, big, luminous eyes and sitting there looking at me like they were hanging on every word I spoke. And I was preaching a sermon about love, telling them how much I loved them and how much my father loved them and my mother loved them and how much God loved them. And how nice it would be if they would could feel it, you know, in their power to respond to that love by providing us with milk. And my father said that he was really impressed with my sincerity, although my motives were not all that clear. But he did say that the effect on the milk production was fairly negligible. But these are the kind of memories that resonate in our minds. And I think every person can call them back if they really have a mind to do that. This morning I sat in on a wonderful session which dealt with the tragedy of AIDS, and under the title, "It Is Not a Matter of Choice." And one of the things that we were asked to do was to write down on little slips of paper what our most treasured possessions are. And of course, it was a part of the message of that session that as she told about the developing tragedy in the life of an AIDS patient. We had to give up in pairs and sometimes in threes these precious possessions. And I mention that only because one of the first things that I wrote on the little slip of paper as among my most treasured possessions were my stories. The stories that have been a part of my life from the very beginnings. I'm going to put you out of your misery right off the bat by telling you what's written on my t-shirt, because I don't want you spending the next hour straining to read these words. It says, back in my early Sunday school days, we used this song called Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam. Whenever we sang that song, all I could think of was my Aunt Ulva's Sunbeam Mixmaster. And so I used to say to myself, Jesus wants me for a Mixmaster? And then I would have a kind of a laughing fit. My problems with religion began very early in my life. The title for this presentation, Starak, We Beseech Thee, goes back to a time in my life when I first became acquainted with a God that I was not about to mess around with. I met this God through the prayers of my father, and it always came near the end of November or the first week in December. And I have this vivid picture of my father standing before the altar and raising his arms up and praying, Staruk, O Lord, thy power. Deliver us from our enemies. And I thought that was a God that you didn't mess around with. I mean, just the name, Staruk, kind of struck a certain amount of respect in my heart. And it appeared that my father was saying that we are involved in a deadly warfare, a life and death struggle, and we are praying that the mighty Lord Staruk will come and fight on our side. I wondered what this mighty Lord Staruk was like. And the answer to my question came, at least to my satisfaction, when I was reading an advertisement in a Good Housekeeping magazine. And there was an advertisement there for Delsey toilet tissue. And this is back in the 30s, and these advertisements featured a large, square-jawed giant of a man. He had a red and white striped shirt and this 5 o'clock shadow. And he was always doing things like picking up a little bird that had fallen out of a nest. Or he would be taping on a Band-Aid on the knee of a little girl that had fallen from her tricycle. And then they always had the Delsey slogan, tough, but oh so gentle. Think about it, it's a wonderful slogan for toilet tissue and for a lot of other things that we need. And I fervently hoped in my heart that that's what the mighty Lord Staruk was like. Tough, but oh so gentle. Sometime later, I began to learn the meaning of some of the names of God. I learned, for example, that El Shaddai is the God of the heights. And Emmanuel is God with us, God among us. So I asked my father, what does Staruk mean? What does that name mean? And he looked at me like I had made up the whole business, as though there was no such person. And I said, how can you say that? I mean, I remember you kneeling before the altar and raising your arms up and praying, Staruk, O Lord, thy power. And he thought, and he began to smile. And he reached behind him and took out the hymn book and read the beautiful collect of the church for the first Sunday in Advent, in which we pray, stir up, O Lord, thy power, and come, that we may be rescued from the threatening perils of our enemies. The interesting thing about it, and I've shared this already with several of you here, The interesting thing about it is that having it explained didn't really change anything. Because the truth of the matter is that deep in my heart, I still believe in the mighty Lord Strzok. And when things really get tough, I pray with all my heart for the mighty Lord Strzok to come and rescue me. All of us, I think, live and die in our stories. I think our stories are what help to constitute us as a human being. I think all of our lives, whether we're aware of the stories or not, I think all of our lives are shaped in a decisive way by the stories that are somehow hidden or evident in our minds and our hearts and our spirits. The theme for this summer is, as you've heard probably many times already, is listening to the sacred. And I believe that our stories are the most basic and fundamental way that we listen to the sacred and we respond to the sacred. I think our stories are the way that we appropriate and process the messages and the experiences that come from the sacred. And I'll go further, and although I can't prove this or probably anything else I say today, but I'll go further and say that I believe that it is in our stories that we become human. And that when we become story starved, or when our stories become warped or distorted, that our humanity withers and dies. Richard Leakey, whose name I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, have heard, a very famous paleontologist and anthropologist, has suggested that we ought to be known as Homo narrans, the animal who narrates, that we are the storytelling animal. And he really believes that human life began when one creature tried to communicate to another creature an experience that they had shared. Maybe they did it with grunts and gestures and later in words, but that process of recognizing experience as story and trying to share that in some way, that this may be the point at which we cross the line in our journey to become truly human. And we know that human community is possible. Genuine human community is possible only when you have a group of people that somehow share a common thread of stories. That stories create and nourish and sustain communities. The primary means by which values are passed on from one generation to another is through stories. Certainly not the only way. There are other important and significant ways, but certainly stories have been a primary vehicle down through the centuries of passing on values from one generation to another. Joseph Campbell, in his books Myths to Live With, and the bookstore tells me that I need to let you know that this book is in the bookstore. Joseph Campbell, as many of you probably know, has traveled all over the world for many years studying the myths and rituals of people all around the world, and thinking about and talking about and teaching about the importance of those mythological stories and rites. And he sees these myths and stories as one of the most important treasures of the human family. And Joseph Smith suggests that these myths and stories speak in the deepest possible way, first of all, to the inner psyche, the inner needs of human beings, but also that those myths and rites were the primary means by which people all over the world have come to make their terms with the cosmos and with the world around them. That's those same stories also mediate and guide us and shape our relationship to the world around us, and that they are a powerful vehicle in our human story and our human experience. I think that's an interesting and wonderful thing to think about, the importance of those myths that have survived for thousands of years in some cases, and have shaped all those generations of people and helped people to deal with the deepest and most profound issues in their life. And that's interesting, and we certainly can pursue it and discuss it if you want to talk about that more. What interests me even more than that is my belief that the discovery and the creating and the sharing of stories is how each of us discovers who we are as a person and how we fit into the larger scheme of things. Everybody here is a collection of stories, told and untold. Stories are one of the most important ways that you make sense out of your experience. It's interesting to think about the marvelous thing that the human mind is. And we know that every moment your mind is receiving literally millions of signals, sights and sounds and smells and feelings. All kinds of things are bombarding your mind. And your mind takes that mass of data, and like it was the most sophisticated computer in the world, your mind takes that raw mass of data and turns it into a story. Your mind takes experience and narrates. In other words, your mind looks for and establishes the connections between all of those things that are coming into your mind and your life. And without that narrating character of your mind, our experience would be a hopeless jumble of confusing sights and sounds and smells. And so that's an interesting thing to think about, how important that narrating character of our minds is for our survival. A lesser issue, but one that fascinates me, like many people, I'm really comfortable, by the way, dealing with lesser issues. Why does my mind retain certain things? Have you ever thought about that? Why you remember certain things and forget other things? I don't know about you, but there are whole chunks of my life, literally years of my life, sort of vanished. I never even think about them. But there are other things that inner person keeps shoving to the surface. Funny little things that I keep thinking about from time to time. Why does that happen? On the face of it, the things that I remember don't seem that important. Little embarrassing moments, little exchanges between myself and my brother, little incidents that occurred, my mind is fastened on them and calls them forth. I'd like to give you just an example. It's a little story that I call The Corn Silk Goddess from Fauston, Minnesota. We had gone to Crooked Lake Bible Camp in northern Minnesota, and we were in the eighth grade. But that's where our similarity ended, because she was from Fauston, Minnesota. They had a population of 3,000 people in Fauston, Minnesota. I was from lowly Gonvick. How many of you have heard of Gonvick, Minnesota? One person. It says on the outside of Gonvick, population 300. That is definitely wishful thinking. I think they went out to the cemetery and counted when they came up with that figure. And she was one of the beautiful people. You know, when we came into the dining hall for supper that first night, I know that not only my eyes, but every pair of eyes in that place gravitated toward the corn silk goddess from Fauston, Minnesota. I was totally smitten right off the bat, no question about it. The next day in chapel, I was sitting there about three rows behind her, and the sunlight was coming in through the window, and it was playing over her blonde hair. The Bible teacher that day was talking about the story of Dives and Lazarus, and I sat there perishing in the flames of unrequited love. And she seemed so far above me and so unreachable that I shouldn't even entertain the thought of anything existing between us. But I was nothing if not desperate, and I remembered that right after chapel, there was going to be swimming and boating at the beach, and there were six rowboats, first come, first served. And so as soon as chapel was over, I was up like a shot and raced down to the waterfront and commandeered one of the boats. And that day, Lady Luck smiled on me. For who should come down to the beach but the corn silk goddess from Fauston, pining for a boat ride, which I was very willing to provide her. And I can still remember that afternoon. It was a beautiful day like this, and I can see the cool stillness of the water, and I can still feel the warm sun on the back of my neck. And in the prow of my boat was the corn silk goddess from Fauston. I thought I would be utterly tongue-tied in her presence, but I wasn't. We talked about all kinds of things. I was amazed at how eloquent I was. I remember one little incident that occurred. This girl leaned over the side of the boat to trail her fingers kind of languidly in the water. She scratched her thigh on an oarlock, and she looked at that and she said, "Damn, now I'll never be Miss America. She has to be perfect, you know." I remember looking at that gleaming thigh and thinking, if I was the judge at the Miss America contest, I certainly would be prepared to overlook that slight imperfection. Now, I wish I could tell you that this story marks the beginning of the first romantic relationship in my life. But the sad truth of the matter is that that one boat ride on the waters of Crooked Lake was the sum total of my relationship to the corn silk goddess from Fauston. It never went beyond that. When our boat touched the shore, she was off. And that was it. Why has my mind fastened on that memory? Why, at the age of 60, when I have my own goddess to wrap my arms around, why is it that from time to time my memory pushes up this little incident? I've thought about that a little bit, and I've kind of come up with what I call the nose on the window pane theory. It says that everybody in the early years of their life has these instances in which they find themselves with their nose pressed against a pane, and you look in on a kind of world of exciting possibilities. A world in which, for a young, shy, awkward boy, even a corn silk goddess isn't necessarily out of reach. Now, I'm curious to know if this little story awakened any recollections in anybody else's mind. When I was telling this story, did you think about anything that happened to you in your early years? Any kind of memory, important or unimportant, come kind of probing back? How many of you found yourself kind of thinking about something when
the story was going on. Okay? The rest of you folks need to get a life.
No, that's mean. That's unfair. That's totally unfair. Maybe it just means you are engrossed in the story, and maybe that's a compliment to me. But I'm just wondering, would anybody like to just share just a little briefly anything you thought of? Anybody?
Oh, well, the performer in me can't resist. You brought up, David, a memory of my first kiss. And I was in the sixth grade, and I was I was just so infatuated with this young man, beautiful young man, who was in the fifth grade. And that was the most embarrassing thing about this relationship. And we exchanged notes in school and did all of those sorts of things. And I lived on the outskirts of the town, and I don't even remember where he lived, but I know he came to visit me one day, which was, I mean, that was really a big deal. And we sat outside and played. I mean, in those days we called it playing. And at some point, I don't know how it happened, he kissed me. And, you know, it was probably when, I don't even remember that part, but it was a wonderful experience, and yet there was this enormous embarrassment because he was in a grade lower than mine. Mm-hmm. Hadn't thought about that in I don't know how many years.
Okay. Anybody else? Anything? You don't even have to tell the whole story or anything, but just kind of what you were thinking about. Yeah.
Well, when we were growing up, we had a tradition where you would give May baskets out, and you would
right,
put a May basket on the door, and you'd knock on the door and run. And then if you saw who we put it there, you're supposed to chase them. And so I knocked on my door, and I saw this little boy running down the street, so I ran running after him, and I ran into our garage. And then when you got there, you're supposed to kiss him, see?
Sure.
So,
you need to take a picture.
That's about right. So I give him this little pick on the cheek, and I ran home. That was really all I remember, but I didn't remember this place. What am I going to do?
That's interesting. Anybody else? Anything you thought of or remembered? I always find that kind of fascinating to see what kind of gets pushed up there.
I remember,
yeah.
I remember it was at a, we went on a winter, what did we call it? A winter, I don't know, a hike or something. Our church, and we were all 11, 12, 13, and I met this girl there, and we just buddied around and had a good time and ran around and got lost together, and, you know, that sort of thing. And something sexual happened. It wasn't anything specific. It just kind of awakened mm-hmm. the sexual thing in me, and it was like I had never experienced that before. And I have no idea. I think it was something like we just happened to brush up against each other. Maybe it was her thigh even. I think I rubbed my hand against her thigh or something when we were walking or something. And I can remember never having felt that way before. And after the day was over, we left, and I think we kind of almost kissed or thought about it or looked at each other and considered it, but never did. And I never saw her since. I can't even remember her name, but it's you made me think about it. I haven't forgotten
mm-hmm.
about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure that was an important and exciting discovery. Yeah, anybody else? I think one of the things that's important for us at this stage in our life too, and why it's helpful to go back to those experiences and those stories, is sometimes it helps us to make peace. Robert Bly has attempted to do with Iron John, and now we have Clarissa Pinkola Estes that has written her magnificent book, Women That Run With Wolves, where she takes stories and uses them as a way of inquiring into some really deep and significant issues that have to do with both women and men. But in this book, Fire in the Belly, Sam Keen goes back and remembers what he looked like as a junior and senior in high school. And he describes it this way, said when he was young, his grandmother gave him a Bible with a note that said, "Read this every day, big boy. It will make you a real man." I felt I was probably destined to fail at being a man. I didn't drink, smoke, or swear. I was the only one in P.S. DuPont High School in Wilmington, Delaware, who wore cowboy boots. I did not shave. I had only a sparse crop of pubic hair and was embarrassed in the locker room. I never got a letter in a major sport. To this day, I avoid anyone in my high school class who is especially old football heroes. I hated fraternities. The only thing that saved me from being a complete geek was that I had a car and a girlfriend, although the car was only a Model A Ford, and to say the least, the girlfriend was not a cheerleader. Today, I look at an old picture of that 17-year-old boy. He's dressed for the senior prom in a rented white dinner jacket, lanky, loose-jointed, two large hands on hips, the pose clearly adopted from Gary Cooper. Next to him stands his girlfriend, Jeanette, already looking mature, dressed in the traditional white gown with the traditional purple orchid, filled with the traditional dreams of settling down. They are both virgins. I see hints in his ungainly adolescent body of the man he will become, in the forward-leaning head, slightly sunken chest, and the forward-curved shoulders is the form of a question mark. In the awkwardness of his pose, I see him trying to be suave for the occasion and play the man he still feels himself to be a boy. I know he will feel boyish, not a man among men, well into his mature years. But it is his face that moves me most, open, shining, filled with the strange power of innocence and strong dreams. His mask of sophistication hides the painful sensitivity he fears is a mark of his inadequacy as a man. I do not see, but remember well the loneliness, the uncertainty, the feeling of being both proud and embarrassed by the secret life the boy was living. His clandestine life included many activities not on the list of requirements for being a real man: keeping a diary, exploring nearby woods and longing for the wilderness, sleeping under the stars, taking long walks alone, waiting and watching to see what would happen when a cowbird laid its eggs in a vitreo's nest, masturbating and imagining the woman of his dreams, wondering about the limits of his mind, exploring his dark moods, writing poetry, reading books and playing with ideas, loving his parents, agonizing about war, poverty, injustice, torture, wanting to do something to make the world better. Today, I honor that boy, knowing that he knew far more about manhood than he thought he knew. For instance, the week after the prom, he set out on his walkabout, a trip across the U.S., working on the wheat harvest, ranches, carnivals. Hidden in his young heart was a craving to discover his own definition of manhood. Father to the man who is writing this book, he did not know, but he had already set out on a pilgrimage, a quest to find the Holy Grail. And I think it's a marvelous passage, and an important one, because it talks to us about how you make peace with those stories and memories and experiences that have been a part of your growing up and your early years. And I'm sure that all of us have struggled in some ways in that same way. Stories can come from anywhere. They can come from sitting and reflecting and thinking about where we live, the home we grew up in, our family. And some I know here at camp have attended workshops, you know, that have very intentionally crafted ways to go back and to try to bring back to life those early memories. And there are lots of ways out there that can help us to do that. Sometimes stories are sparked in us by something we pick up and read. A good friend of mine is a very fine poet, Gracia Grindal. And Gracia has done, if you look in the LBW, you'll see that that a number of the words for hymns have been rewritten by Gracia Grindal. She now teaches at Luther Northwestern Seminary in St. Paul. But Gracia wrote a poem about Bible camp. And she lived in a whole different part of the country than I grew up in. But when I was young, during the summer, our family would go to Bible camp. That was our summer vacation, 3 weeks of Bible camp. And because my father was always involved in the program of the Bible camps. And when I read Gracia's poem, I couldn't believe it, because she was in the same camp I was. I mean, everything, from the perfume that the girls wore to the songs that were played and the flaming cross out on the lake and the quiet hours. And her poem was an almost perfect presentation of the memories that I have of Bible camp, and I'd like to share that with you too, just very quickly. Someone who can't is playing chopsticks on an out-of-tune piano in the chapel. And deep in the kitchen, bottle gas gives off the blue odor of Bible camp that mixes in with campfires, ashes, wet cement, and Lysol bathrooms. And my father's cardboard college suitcase lies unruffled on the stool by my bunk. The soap clearly marked Lux after 5 days, and all my wash rags folded square as only mothers can. And two girls giggle about boys over in the corner and what they did out on the point, who snuck in late after the campfire, and the singing of the boat full of counselors to campers on the shore, where a cross soaked in gas blazed the gospel while we sang hallelujah, hallelujah, Jacob's ladder and living for Jesus. The boys on one verse, the girls on the other, all together on the end. And we huddle around the warm light, looking down into the dirt as we scuff with tennis shoes. We testify for Jesus while the group hums, I will not be afraid. And later, boys rasp in their throats and ask the girls beside them, smelling of Noxema, heaven sent, and ban, to come along to the canteen for Coke and maybe for a walk out to the point where the stars twinkle on the small lake. The preachers and their wives sit in the main cabin laughing. They're telling Norwegian jokes when all the kids are bedded down, and the men will drive toward Puget Sound to buy the women blueberry pie. Tomorrow, one of them will give a Bible study on a short book of Paul in Philippians. We'll underline the words joy, Jesus, others, you, 100 times, and memorize the promises, one for every day, and learn the ABCs of the epistle packing apostles, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. And one of the counselors will play gospel songs on a saw and answer questions campers have about holding hands in church, and later after lunch and quiet time, when we have broken down in groups to witness for the Lord. And I will ask the preacher's wife, what does divers mean? Thinking of water. And she will say, greatly alarmed, that God will someday deal with us for wearing clothes of diverse, meaning mixed material. And don't I love my Savior? Ah, yes, I do. The swimmers on the float glisten as they buddy up to whistles. And yes, I do. Forever yours and Snickers caramel on my tongue. And yes, I love my Jesus. Walking in the dark, where lovers walk near water lilies. He's the bright and morning star. And down at the end of the lake, far away and on a green hill, the cross is burning down, crimson in the water. and the clear laugh of women sounds across the lake where preacher's car turns in to bring home blueberry pie. We are the blessed little flock, beloved of the Lord, the twinkling in the Father's eye. And I know just what she's talking about, because that was a Bible camp for me in the age of innocence in Corn Silk Goddesses from Fauston, Minnesota. It's interesting to think about where our stories come from and how they come to us. I just wanted, and I thought you might be interested in hearing a story in the making. This morning I went to the bookstore and bought a beautiful book of poems that's written by Karen Herseth Lee, one of the program directors here at the camp. I'm sure many of you have met her. And she has a wonderful book of poems in which she speaks about many things that have happened to her in her life, all the way from her childhood out in the Dakota prairies to her marriage and traveling with David to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and to other various places, and having children of her own, and talking about her experiences of love and fear. And it's a wonderful book, $10 in the bookstore. And reading her poems, where she talks about riding out onto the Dakota prairies and getting down and looking at the flowers and feeling of the earth, reminded me of the story that I shared as a part of the 4th of July celebration, where I talked about digging foxholes in the earth behind the barn. During the Second World War, my brother Paul and I decided to wage war against the Japanese. And so we went down the hill behind the barn and dug foxholes in the soft earth. And I was reminded of the experience of getting into those foxholes and sitting there and sort of feeling that cold earth around me. And then we covered them over with tree branches and became a roof. And the interesting thing about the experience was that we had dug those foxholes to wage war. But our experiences have a life of their own. And sitting down there in that foxhole and being close to the earth and getting a little inkling of what it's like to have a place of your own that you've carved out in the earth, and to feel that close presence of the earth around me really, in a sense, nudged me away from thoughts of war to think about what it means to have a place and what it means to be looking forward to one day having a shelter of my own that will wrap around me and my family. And thinking about that brought to mind another memory. My father died about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was about 9 years, or about 9 months after his death, that I had a dream. And it was a very clear and vivid dream. I found myself looking out a window, and I was looking out on kind of a broad, clear prairie. And there was my father, and he was digging a hole. And he had a very peaceful, tranquil look on his face. And he was digging away, and then he sat down in his hole. And to begin with, it only covered him up to his legs and up to his hip. And then, a while later, I found myself looking again. And now my father was in the hole up to his armpits. And he still wore that peaceful, tranquil look on his face. And it looked like he was looking out at the prairie. He wasn't looking up at me or anywhere else, but simply looking ahead. A short time later, I looked again in the dream, and all I could see was my father's head. And he still had that peaceful look on his face. And for some reason, it was an immensely comforting dream. It was as though my father was saying, "I'm going through a great change, but it's all right. You don't have to feel bad about it or feel afraid. It's okay." And it wasn't until this morning that those two pictures came to mind that I thought, my father was digging a foxhole. He was digging out a place in the earth to enter. And he may have had one agenda, but now that place is enfolding him. And that place will have a life of its own. And it will be okay. It will be okay for him. And it will be okay for us. And so that's the beginnings of a story that I want to spend more time thinking about and working on, because stories too have a life of their own, and they have a way of shaping us. And so when I began, I probably was not telling the truth when I said that my most precious possessions are my stories. Because you could argue that we never possess our stories. It might be more accurate to say that we are possessed by our stories. That we do not control them. And we cannot control what they do in our minds and in our hearts and in our lives. I'd like to, and I apologize, the next time this particular class meets, or this topic will be pursued, will be on Wednesday, and the title of that presentation is Listening to the Turtle. And what we'd like to talk about and think about that day is the role of stories in mediating our relationship to the land and to the world around us. Stories that help to enhance in us a sense of identity with the land and a desire to respect and to care for and be nourished by the land and the whole created order around us. And if any of you are coming back on Wednesday, I'd encourage you to think about places that have been important to you. When you think back over your life, maybe in your early years, maybe more recently, but a place that represents a kind of treasured geography for you. And to think about that place and the sights and smells and sounds of that place, the people that may or may not have been there, and the kind of things that you maybe might have experienced. And we'll try to set aside a little bit of time if any of you have the need or desire to share something about that experience. Or anything else, we will be prepared at any moment to lay aside our agenda, to open the door to a story that needs to be told. When our car reached the crest of the hill above the Mississippi River at Prairie du Chien, I thought that we had died and gone to heaven. We had lived in the Dakotas during the Dust Bowl years. And when I looked down on the Mississippi River and saw the wooded hills of Wisconsin in all the blazing colors of autumn, it was the most beautiful sight that I'd ever seen in my life. A few days later, tired and broke, my father's 1938 Ford pulled into the driveway in front of the New Hope Lutheran Parsonage near Stevens Point, Wisconsin. It was the largest house I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, it looked like a palace for a king, or at least a governor. For the first time in my life, my brother Paul and I were each going to have a room of our own. And that was an incredible gift. We were out of the door in a shot, running up to explore the house. But before we left the car, I remember my mother, who probably saw that house in a little different light than we did. I remember her looking over at my father and saying, "They must expect the pastor's wife to do a lot of entertaining." Mm-hmm. And of course they did. Over the next 5 years, the old house was to see a steady procession of guests that came, representatives of the church that came raising funds for various purposes, guest speakers that my father had invited, friends and relatives that just needed a place to nest for a while, in a few cases for several months. Our favorite guests were the missionaries that came with their big bulging suitcases full of all kinds of wonderful things from places in the world that we had read about in the National Geographic, but were never completely convinced actually existed until we talked to people that had been there. And they opened up their suitcases and they were filled with all kinds of wonderful things. I remember a missionary from India that had little tiny red beads that came apart, and inside was a little elephant carved out of a small flake of ivory. I can remember missionaries from China that had beautiful red lacquered boxes and fine silks. Missionaries from Africa that had carved wooden masks out of ebony. And always they brought their stories of the places where they had been and the experiences that they had had. And what always came shining through was the excitement and the wonder of those places, and also their love for the people with whom they had come to know in those places. One of the first rooms my brother Paul and I explored was the attic. And when we went up into the attic, and I can still remember that kind of dusty, sort of acrid smell of that attic when we got up there, and we made a wonderful discovery. Because hanging from the rafters and around the chimney were hundreds of bats hanging. And my brother Paul and I recognized the potential of that right off the bat. And so we raced down to tell my mother about this grave threat to her well-being. And she hired us on the spot to exterminate the bats at a nickel apiece. And that was to provide a steady stream of income for us for the next 5 years. And I know this is shocking to all of us here who have become lovers of nature, but my biologist daughter has assured me that we probably never even dented the bat population. In fact, we probably improved the quality, if not the quantity, of the bat flock. There were many other things in that house. I remember a room that didn't belong to anybody. It was just a room that was left over. And by the time we got there, it was already about half full of old suitcases and boxes and discarded pieces of furniture that had been left by previous inhabitants of the house and that steady stream of guests that flowed through there. Of course, my mother reminded us that those boxes all belonged to somebody. Was somebody's private property. And so we were forbade to look into any of those boxes, which of course practically guaranteed that my brother Paul and I would look through every one of them. The one feeling that I want to convey to you about the old house was the immense feeling of security that it gave us. This was when the World War was raging. And in a sense, the world was falling apart. But my brother Paul and I felt that within the shelter of that old house with its deep foundations and its thick walls, that we would always be safe and secure. And that wall would reach out to shelter my family and also their possessions. My father's beautiful library. He was a photographer and he had a dark room with his own enlarger and equipment for developing films and making prints. My mother had Wedgwood china and sterling silver that she bought when she was a school teacher and before she married a preacher. And I had a brand new gold cardigan sweater that my mother had bought at the J.C. Penney store in Stevens Point. School was starting the next day, and so this sweater was hanging in my closet. And beside my bed was a shiny pair of new shoes that I was going to wear to school the next morning. And we went to bed, and the rain started, and it was a wonderful, gentle rain. The old parsonage had a tin roof on it, and one of the most beautiful sounds in all the world is rain on a tin roof. And it lulled me off to sleep, and I heard a roll of thunder and a flash of lightning. And it seemed very close, but the house was unshaken, and so I went back to sleep. And what happened next is a kind of a confused blur in my mind. But the next thing I knew, I felt someone shaking my shoulder, telling me to get up, that the house was on fire. And I got up out of the bed, and all I had time to do was really to grope my way to the stairway going down to the front door. And as I got to the front door, I could look back down the hallway where the kitchen was, and there was a door there with a glass window in it. And through that window, I could see the flames licking, and I could hear this strange noise of the fire devouring this old house. And it was all over in a few minutes. All that accumulation of all those inhabitants and those dried out old timbers all became fuel for the fire. The rain was still coming down, and so my father hustled us toward the old Ford to get us in out of the rain. And we sat there watching the old house disappear before our eyes. We experienced in that moment what it meant to be dispossessed, to literally lose everything that we possessed in material goods. We were all safe and sound, but the old house was gone. My father, from force of habit, reached into the glove compartment of his car, and he had an old Argus C3 camera in the glove compartment, and he snapped two pictures. And as he snapped the second picture, the roof of the old house blew up and the flames went broiling up into the air. It began as a little Kodachrome slide, and a few years back my son Steve took the slide and had it made into a print, and later had it made into this enlargement, which he gave to me on my birthday. Little knowing that even after more than 40 years, it still gives me some exquisite pain to look at the death of the old house. Some years later, I went back with my own children, and we had told the story of the great fire many times, and they wanted to go and visit the place where the old house was. And so we went back there, and the house had never been rebuilt, and it was all grown up in trees. It actually took us several minutes to find the crumbling foundations of the old house. But after a while we found it, and before I knew it, my children were climbing down into the basement of the old house. And there in the corner, they found the remains of a narrow old rusting bed on which their father was sleeping the night of the great fire. And for some reason, this was an immensely healing experience for me, to see my own children digging around in the ashes of my childhood. And because I'm a storyteller, I guess I believe that it's because one of our deepest needs is to tell our stories, and to know that our stories have been heard and believed, and that they make a difference to the people that come after us. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you.